Hello, I'm Father Ambrose Little, the director of the Thomistic Institute. Before we begin the next great TI lecture, a quick word with you. Thanks to donors like you, our content is cutting through the digital noise with the truth of the Catholic intellectual tradition. But we can't keep it coming without your help. If you enjoy programs like the TI Podcast and Aquinas 101, please consider a small contribution of $25 or more. You can use the link in the description or visit our website to donate. Your generosity ensures that these important programs will continue to lead souls to the truth all over the world. So please enjoy this episode, and may God bless you and keep you in His grace.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In order to whet your appetites for what's to come, I'd like to tell you the story behind my choice of the phrase musical dependence, which is Talk version 3.0. Version 1.0 was musical addiction. I wanted to go with this because I believe that some of us are addicted to music and that many of us are headed there unless we take drastic action to reverse course. I rejected version 1.0 because it deterred two groups of people that I didn't want to deter from coming to the talk. First, people who suspect that they're addicts but don't want to admit it, either privately to themselves or publicly by showing up to a lecture on addiction. And secondly, people who love music and therefore spurn anyone who speaks of music on the same level as heroin, alcohol, or chocolate. Version 2.0 was the abuse of music. My intention here was to attract the music lovers and not scare off the addicts. I rejected version 2.0, though, because it deterred everyone who wasn't willing to call himself a music abuser. And that probably includes both the lovers and the addicts. I settled definitively on version 3.0, musical dependence, after returning from a visit to an out-of-state Thomistic Institute chapter, which ought to get the prize for being the first chapter to take me to two bars in a single day. First for lunch, and second for a seminar. And incidentally, I was disappointed when the lecture itself was held in a dry situation. I'm not telling this to shame you, dear local chapter, for not hosting this in a bar, but to point to a phenomenon that occurs in bars and that could occur outside of a bar and without alcohol. Some of the people who drink in bars drink not in order to enjoy the drink, but in order to make some other aspect of life, which they'll encounter when they leave the bar, tolerable. It seems to me that many of us do just this with music. I'll elaborate on this thesis in four parts. In musical terminology, after this prelude, in the first movement, I'll point to evidence that we are in an overly dependent relationship with music, and then I'll make some philosophically educated guesses as to how we got where we are. Then we'll have an interlude, where I'll make some mostly useless, but definitely fascinating philosophical observations about the goodness and the nature of music. In the second movement, I'll propose a few difficult but possible steps that we can take if we don't wish to remain where we are. And then we'll have the postlude, which for now will remain a mystery. The first movement. How did we get here? In order to figure out how you got to a certain point, you have to retrace your steps, either physically or in your memory. But when you were born at a certain point with certain dispositions, the steps that you need to retrace aren't your own, but your ancestors. Retracing other people's steps is tricky, especially when they aren't around to correct us and fill in the gaps. I don't have a way to overcome the trickiness of this task, but I'll let you know that I'm aware of the trickiness and that I have consulted two people who can help to fill in the gaps. The first person is Aristotle, who has a lot to say about the use of music in education, the enjoyment of music in a life lived well, and the abuse of music in a life lived not so well. The second person that I have consulted is me. I had the good fortune of being born in a decade when all phones had cords, and none of them were cameras or audio players, when record players weren't yet vintage, and when beatboxing, or at least attempts at beatboxing, was common. I was immersed in listening to and playing and singing music long, long before I began philosophizing about it. So my present philosophical self consulted my younger, pre-philosophical, music-loving self. With a view, then, to eventually seeing how we ended up where we are now, I'll first rewind to a time long, long before now. I'll tell four hypothetical stories about the enjoyment and use of music, starting with a very old story and getting closer to us in time. And the fourth and final story will be about us. Then I'll circle back and make some observations about what changed from story to story. Without further ado, I invite you to consider a time before earbuds, MP3s, and CDs, before boomboxes, cassettes, radio, and gramophones, and even before professional instrument makers and professional musicians. Once upon a time, in the 820s BC, in a very rural area, there lived the Doe family, John and Jane, and their kids, Jack and Jill. It's too much to look at how music shows up in four people's lives, so let's focus first on John. John spends almost all of the daylight hours working in the forest and the field, working to ensure that he and his family have enough to eat. Some of his work is difficult, requiring intense concentration, and for these moments, he's silent. When his work is routine, though, he sings or whistles, not to distract himself, but to express to God and to anyone in earshot what he's feeling. It's worth mentioning that John enjoys his work, even and especially when it's hard. He enjoys having everything that's in him drawn forth. He enjoys being able to do something that's meaningful. The meaning of his work, that's to say, the reason why he works, is so that he can eventually stop working and enjoy being with his family. When the family is together, everyone picks up his own instrument, which John made, of course, and sings and plays together. The only musical theory or training that the Doe family has had is experimentation and discipline. They discovered by playing around what's pleasant and what's not, and they cared enough to remember what they discovered. All of the playing around and remembering, of course, was only for the sake of playing around, for the sake of enjoying being with one another and putting into song what they thought was worth remembering. Once upon a second time, in the 220s BC, in an urban area, wealthy for its time, there lived the Doe family, John and Jane and their kids, Jack and Jill. Jack does very little work. Not because he's lazy, but because there are slaves to do all the things that he needs to have done. Jack spends his days learning how to delight in music. He learns this not by studying how to play music well, this can be left to the slaves, but by studying musical theory. In theory, the more he knows about what music should be, the more he can delight in hearing a well-composed and well-played tune. Besides music, Jack also studies gymnastics, reading and writing, and drawing. Although Jack is supposed to be delighting in music for its own sake, he frequently finds himself turning to music as a break. This is to say, as a relief from the discipline of his previous activities and as a restoration for the activities ahead. Although Jack could, in theory, sing to himself during these breaks, he seldom does, since there are slaves around who can perform for Jack whatever tune he wishes to hear. The slaves, of course, can't come to the gymnasium to sing while Jack works, but the absence of music during these times makes Jack turn to it ever more readily whenever he wants to be restored from and for his work. Once upon a third time, in the 1980s, in a suburban area, there lived the Doe family. John and Jane and their kids, Jack and Jill. Jill, of course, has no slaves. She sometimes complains as though she's a slave when she's forced to take piano lessons, but her parents just tell her that it's good discipline and that she's lucky to have the opportunity to acquire musical skill. What Jill really feels lucky to have, though, is a Walkman tape player with headphones. Her Walkman makes it possible for her to hear famous compositions performed by famous composers, Genesis, U2, Van Halen, without having to bother the performers for a performance. The Walkman also allows her to listen to music whenever and wherever she wants, or at least when and where her parents allow it. Since Jill can listen to music while doing other things, she rarely simply listens to music for its own sake, or even for the sake of relaxation. She listens to music while she's studying because she doesn't like studying, and the music makes the studying more tolerable. She listens to music during family dinner time because the music is more enjoyable for her than hearing about everyone else's sad day. She listens to music before field hockey games because the music makes her feel more confident and more willing to endure the pain required for victory. And she listens to music with her friends after field hockey games because enjoying the same thing makes them enjoy one another all the more. Once upon a final time, in the 2020s, in an area entirely accessible to Wi-Fi, 5G, and Amazon delivery, there lived four individuals with the last name Doe. Jane's life is better than that of a movie star. She can hear the soundtrack of her life, and the soundtrack is constant. Armed with earbuds, a smartphone, and familiarity with several generative AI apps, Jane's ability to listen to music is seemingly unlimited. She doesn't bother going to concerts, waiting for U2 to come out with yet another new album, or even shuffling through the old songs to find the ones she likes. The algorithms know precisely how much familiarity and how much novelty she likes, and they provide precisely that: AI composed, AI performed, and AI delivered. Jane has been relieved of all of the labor that she might have put forth into listening to music. This is hardly something that Jane chose for herself. Her ways of using music are nothing more and nothing less than what everyone else does. She's also committed to being a not-so-weird member of the culture, the same culture that pipes music into waiting rooms and puts music behind podcasts just in case you didn't know what feeling you ought to be having. Like everyone else, Jane is so awash in easy music that what she notices isn't music, but silence. And what she notices in silence is that she doesn't know how to feel. And that makes her feel at once bored and again terrified. The one thing that Jane has chosen, as far as music is concerned, is to pick up the banjo. She figures that, as her parents insisted, learning an instrument is valuable for discipline. She figures that she should value discipline, even though she doesn't really care for banjo music. She also figures that giving banjo a try can't hurt, especially since there are so many AI-powered instructional tools. What we're looking for now is the big story that unfolds through these four little stories. What's the story, in other words, that tells us why one story follows after another? In musical terms, we're looking for the musical themes that are passed along, slightly altered from age to age, and the rationale for how these themes develop. In anecdotal terms, one of my favorite recordings that I listened to in my childhood was Leonard Bernstein's narration of Peter and the Wolf. Bernstein would direct the listener's attention to a single instrument, like the oboe, and then to another, like the strings, and then allow the listener to take in the whole orchestra with an appreciation for its parts. I'm going to try to do something similar here by focusing first on one theme and then another. Theme number one: how personal and interpersonal is our relationship with music? I'll elaborate on this theme by looking primarily at who or what is responsible for playing the music that we listen to. Since it makes a difference whether the responsible person is performing or playing around, let me clarify that distinction here. Performers pay attention to what they have to do and to what they're not supposed to do. They do this because they're playing primarily for other people rather than for their own enjoyment. Players, on the other hand, pay attention only to what they get to do and what they can do. And they do this because they're playing for their own enjoyment, which they perhaps share for others. John's relationship with music is deeply personal and interpersonal. He plays his own music, with or without others, but usually with. He doesn't perform, since he has no need for musical perfection. He and those with whom he lives sing and play as freely as they live. Jack's relationship with music is interpersonal, but not deeply so. Jack neither performs nor plays around with music. Slaves perform music for him, such that the limit on Jack's ability to listen to music is the limit of the slave. The slave can't accompany Jack everywhere, singing and playing, and so obviously Jack can't listen to music without being with the performer. So Jack's experience of music is still, like John's, personal and punctuated by silence. Jill's relationship with music is complicated. During her piano practices, she might play around, but since she's taking lessons for discipline, her attitude is more like that of a slave, performing, than that of fancy-free John. Primarily, her relationship with music is impersonal. When she listens to her Walkman, she's not with the performer, the modern slave, and she's also not really with her Walkman. Because the Walkman can accompany her almost everywhere, she's able to listen to music in a kind of interpersonal isolation that needn't be punctuated by silence, even if it happens to be. Jane's relationship with music is distinctively impersonal. Unlike Jill, who had to wait for human performers to perform and record, Jane doesn't need to wait on anyone. Her experience of music has the potential for being utterly isolated, utterly private, save for the occasions when she wants to signal to her tribe that she's listening to the right music. Neither Jane nor other people in her life play around with music nor perform. The only hope that we might have for Jane is that she abandons her commitment to discipline and happens to enjoy playing around on the banjo. To sum up theme one, our relationship with music has become less interpersonal the less we rely on the human beings with whom we live to play and enjoy music. Theme two, what are we listening to music for? I'll elaborate on this theme by using some Greek terms coined by Aristotle, the second of which is almost unpronounceable, kinetic and entelecheic. Gotta do the guttural. I'll use these terms first because the more familiar terms, such as work and leisure, or operatio and oxio, have connotations that cloud rather than clarify what we're seeking to understand. And second, because you'll sound much smarter if you can pull out the Greek terms in casual conversation. Both of these terms, kinetic and entelecheic, describe kinds of human activities. Every activity is either kinetic or entelecheic, and no activity can be both at the same time and in the same respect. In your imagination, represent a kinetic activity as a straight arrow, or a ray, if you prefer. If you do this on paper, I will be collecting and grading them at the end of the talk. Kinetic activities are activities that we engage in precisely in order to move from one point to another in a linear fashion. Direction matters. You can perform kinetic activities faster or slower, more efficiently or less, and you can fail at kinetic activities if you fail to reach the point that you set out to reach. Kinetic activities can be easy or hard, and we might enjoy them or not, but even if they're hard and unpleasant, we enjoy having gotten them done. Some examples. Getting yourself to a deserted place to see the sunrise. Building an adoration chapel. Writing a song. In your imagination, represent an entelechaic activity as a circle, with arrows encouraging you to keep moving around, like the loading symbol on Windows. Entelechaic activities are activities where the point isn't anything beyond the activity itself. The point isn't to get to the other side of the circle, but just to enjoy moving around in a circle. Direction doesn't matter, but only being in the circle. These kinds of activities are inherently enjoyable, or they can be if we're paying attention. Entelechaic activities are ones for which the phrases hurry up and thank goodness that's over make no sense. For example, seeing the sunrise, being with God in an adoration chapel, enjoying a song. Before examining the Dove family's relationship with music through the lens of these terms, let me make two remarks and introduce another great Aristotelian phrase that you can pull out the next time that you're at a bar. First, the activity of being pleased is always entelechaic. Since whenever we voluntarily listen to music, we're doing so in order to be pleased, listening to music is always entelechaic. Second, when we're performing a kinetic activity, like building an adoration chapel, we can at the same time also enjoy building the adoration chapel. The enjoyment is entelechaic, even though the activity we're enjoying is kinetic. We could depict, say, James building a chapel and enjoying building as an arrow piercing a circle. The arrow and the circle are of the same color, let's say blue. Since James's enjoyment comes from nothing more than the activity of building and his attending to this activity. In contrast, when James listens to music while folding the laundry, he's a unique guy. The arrow is blue and the circle is chartreuse, which of course is the color of aliens. The music is an alien pleasure. That's your phrase. An alien pleasure which doesn't arise from folding the laundry, but rather from an alien activity that is layered on top. Note that using music as an alien pleasure is really just a sophisticated version of using music for the sake of work, namely of putting the circle before the arrow. Applying this to the does. John listens to music simply because it's enjoyable. He works, that's to say he does his kinetic activities, so that he can enjoy music. Let's represent this as an arrow followed by a circle. John also enjoys his work, so we can add circles being pierced by the arrows. Since John's life is just a cycle of moving from enjoying work to enjoying music, his whole life is like one huge circle, comprised of arrows with circles within the large circle. Jack listens to music, sometimes because it's enjoyable, but other times in order to refresh himself from past work and prepare for future work. In this case, he listens to music so that he can work. Let's represent this as an arrow followed by a circle followed by an arrow. We don't know whether Jack enjoys his work, so let's hold off on saying what the overall shape of Jack's life assumes. Jill, because she has a Walkman, seldom just listens to music. Usually, she listens to music while doing another activity. She does this sometimes in order to assist her performance of another activity. Listening to music before she plays a field hockey game assists her ability to play with aggression and confidence. Let's represent this as a blue arrow that's moving through a chartreuse circle, where the game is the arrow and the pleasure of the music is the circle. Listening to music with her team after they've played a game assists the delight of being with her teammates. So represent this as a blue circle surrounded by a chartreuse circle. At other times, Jill uses music to distract herself as she performs another activity. Listening to music while she studies distracts her with pleasure from the unpleasant activity of studying. Let's represent this as a chartreuse circle floating above the blue arrow. And incidentally, the non-Doe family example of this that I have from my childhood is that at one point I needed to take some sort of an antibiotic long before I could swallow ordinary pills. And my dad decided that it would be really good to crush up the pill and put it into raspberry jam that was taken from the raspberries from my backyard. I used to love raspberry jam. But anyhow, I think that this is something like what we do when we sweeten an activity with music. All right. Lastly, Jill, in listening to music while she's at the dinner table, this distracts her from the unpleasant activity of being sad with her family. The Does have a difficult life. Let's represent this as a chartreuse circle above a blue circle. Jane has all the same tendencies as Jill, but she experiences more keenly the consequences of a life built upon these tendencies. Three of these consequences are as follows. First, since Jane has the ability to choose what emotion she experiences in any given activity, by choosing what music she listens to, or at least by not choosing to turn the music off, her ability to recognize and to metabolize her emotions naturally atrophies. Or, if she was exposed to chronic music from an early age, her ability remains underdeveloped. One of the signs of this is restlessness with any and all music, and our responses to this restlessness vary. Second, and as a possible response to restlessness, since music has made all of Jane's kinetic activities easier, she reaches out, ironically, to learning music as a kind of work, as a kind of discipline. She does this as a way of importing into her life some activity that's meaningful. But it's rather tragic. Jane is doing something alone for discipline that her predecessors did together for sheer delight. Third, since turning to music as assistive or distractive is using music for the sake of work, Jane's whole life begins to take the shape of a blue arrow piercing a chartreuse circle. And the arrow is heading nowhere. Why? The more Jane uses music for the sake of getting work done, the less she realizes what she's doing any of the work for. And the more she'll tolerate more and more meaningless arrows. In Thomistic terms, she's lost the final cause. Jane obviously is in a bad spot. In case this is a little concerning to you, let's distract ourselves for a few moments with an interlude. What I'm calling an interlude is really just three responses to three speculative questions about music that are interesting and that didn't fit into the other sections of this talk. In order to disguise the self-indulgent nature of the questions, I will pose them as though they came from you. Question one. Sister, can you give an Aristotelian Thomistic account of the ontology of music? Of what it is about music that lends it to being not merely enjoyed for its own sake, but used and abused because it's able to be layered onto other activities? Reply. Sure. Music is uniquely able to layer onto other activities because it's an entelechic activity. We don't have to move it along by any effort. So we can let it move us as we attend to something else that does need our effort. Music can't be layered onto just any activity, though. Activities that require our full attention, such as solving difficult math problems, or having a difficult conversation, aren't assisted by music. Music in these cases would distract rather than assist. We would find ourselves torn or exhausted by trying to attend to both the music and to the conversation. Most likely, we would resolve the tension by tuning one of them out, or else by turning to mindless snacking, which can be layered on to intellectual activities. That's another talk, though. The reason why we are inclined to layer music onto as many activities as we can is because music has the capacity to engage us pleasantly in three ways. In one way, music engages our body to bring about a certain passion. That's to say, to bring about the kinds of emotions that we have as animals. This phenomenon is called catharsis, and it happens in this way. Musical sound waves, which are physical, move our bodies, which are physical, in the same way that our bodies ordinarily are moved from the inside when we're experiencing an emotion. What takes place is an inversion of the usual order of stimulus response. Usually, we begin to get angry by noticing something unjust, and then our bodies produce adrenaline and heat. When we hear a certain beat or tune, though, we begin by experiencing our bodies producing adrenaline and heat, and then we look around for the cause of the injustice. To use a non-human example of this, before I entered the convent, I had a parrot. I taught him to say, "Come in," when someone knocked on the door. But perhaps because my parrot associated "come in" with the excitement of a visitor, he would occasionally say, "Come in," when I was being particularly boring. Another way that music engages us pleasantly is by engaging our memories, both our sense memory, which retains emotions, and our intellectual memory, which retains judgments. For example, for most of us, listening to Forever Young brings up the memory of an eighth grade dance. This memory will be as pleasant to you as your eighth grade dance was. And in a third way, music can engage us on an intellectual level. If you know something about jazz modes and musical theory, you can listen to Miles Davis's rendition of Autumn Leaves and be pleased, both because you judge that the tune is an amazing composition and because you judge that Miles Davis performs it beautifully. Question two. Sister, can we get a specific example of the good use of music that doesn't involve the Doe family? Reply, sure. Let's pick a topic that's never controversial. Music in the liturgy. To begin, it's definitely the case that we use music in the liturgy. We don't or we shouldn't attend a liturgy simply in order to listen to music. In that case, we would be using the liturgy in order to listen to music. That's backwards, though. Music ought to be used to assist the fundamental activity of the liturgy, worship of and union with God. Moving on. Music assists worship if and only if it directs our attention to the meaning of the words of the liturgy. Ideally, we worship God with all our mind and all our heart. The words are there to direct our mind to surrender, repentance, petition, etc. And the music is there to assist our heart or our affections in echoing what our mind says with words. If the music makes us feel an emotion that doesn't match the emotion that we would feel if we were really meaning the words that we were saying, then the music doesn't assist, it distracts. An example. Suppose you hear the tune. How does it make you feel without words? Next, what feeling would assist your wholehearted focus on the meaning of the text? To the Father unbegotten and the sole begotten Son, be salvation, blessing, honor, jubilation, power, and praise. There's a mismatch there. So the music distracts us from the worship. And this would be an abuse of music. But try a different tune, selected because it's appropriate, and this will be the good use of music. Genitori genitoque, laus et jubilatio. I'll just throw out here three more observations that I'll be happy to explain in the question and answer session if there's interest. First, I'm not saying that the abuse of music in the liturgy is restricted to the use of secular tunes, such as Oh My Darlin'. It's possible for fixed chant phrases designed for use with a certain kind of text to be artificially employed to text for whose meaning the tune is inappropriate. Second, the abuse of music obviously isn't restricted to the liturgy. We can do it, usually unconsciously and with good intentions, even in our speech. When our musical range says something different than what our words say. Third, there are times when music is inappropriate because our heart and our mind has already been wholly concentrated on something that is present. What comes to mind here is an account I once heard about St. John of the Cross just after he was released from being held in prison by his fellow brothers. The Carmelite nuns greeted him and began to sing to him a song about suffering that they had composed. He collapsed on the floor and begged for silence. Question three. So will there be silence in heaven? Will the angels be singing? Will we be singing? Reply. Keeping in mind that my observations here are philosophical and speculative and fallible, I would say, in a sense, yes, and in a sense, no. Yes, we will be singing, in that our delight in heaven will be both intellectual and body, mind, heart, and body. Our delight, moreover, won't be kinetic, but entelecheic, and music supports all of this. But no, we won't be singing in this sense. There won't be any songs in heaven, since a song requires us to shift our attention from one note to the next. In heaven, all of our attention will be on one thing, the eternal exchange of love between the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in which we will be caught up, not as spectators, but as members of the body of the Son. If there is music in heaven, it will be like one amazing chord, with the three divine persons and all God's creatures praising the Trinity with all their being. Each of us is our own instrument, crafted in this life and purified by his love. And that will be all we are doing. For now, however, there's more that we need to do, so let's return to Jane in the second movement. Is there any hope for Jane? Recall that before the interlude, we left Jane in the same sorry state in which we found her. She was caught in a second order kinetic pattern, doing task after task, not really knowing why she's doing any of it, but driven by the vague sense that this is both all she can do and all that she ought to do. Her situation is both a little more comfortable and a little more dire, since each of the tasks she performs is accompanied by music. This is more comfortable because the music is inherently pleasant, but more dire because the musical accompaniment makes the meaninglessness of it all tolerable. Jane's situation will remain dire unless the shape of her life changes from a big arrow heading to nowhere except more tasks to a big circle heading nowhere except from present delight to present delight. There are a few things within Jane's power that she's probably already tried and that will not affect this overall change, because they merely rehearse the overall second-order kinetic pattern. These include adding more tasks to her day to distract her from the meaninglessness, reducing her daily tasks to reduce the exhaustion that comes from them, or adding more entelecheic activities with a view to being more equipped for her tasks. The only thing that Jane can do to affect overall change is changing how she approaches her kinetic tasks and how she approaches entelechic activities. Experience shows that Jane can't change one of these without the other at the same time, without changing the other at the same time. Experience also shows that Jane can only change both of her attitudes if she takes two steps at the same time. One of these steps is to turn away from using music. She does this in order to make other non-musical activities more tolerable. Let's call this asceticism, and let's imagine it as a turning away. If Jane turns away from using music as a kind of a drug, she'll experience almost immediately a bit of pain and a bit of boredom. If she perseveres through these withdrawal symptoms, if she doesn't turn to another drug to distract her from the pain and to fill the boredom, her sensitivity will increase to what's alive in the boredom, as her tolerance for meaninglessness decreases, her sensitivity to meaning increases. When she walks to work without earbuds, she'll begin to notice people's faces, and perhaps she'll try whistling, and maybe she'll enjoy it. The other step that Jane will need to take, other than turning away from using music, is to turn toward enjoying whatever activity with which she's presently engaged. Even if the activity with which Jane is presently engaged is something kinetic, something she has to do, like waiting in a TSA line, and even if the activity is unpleasant, like waiting in a TSA line, there are still three things that Jane can turn her attention to and enjoy. She can enjoy being with God, who is with her as she waits in the TSA line. She can enjoy being with others who are physically with her as she waits in the TSA line. And she can enjoy being the kind of being who can enjoy being in a TSA line. We are the only beings who care to do things well. We are also the only beings who can make and enjoy music out of sheer delight. If Jane takes these two steps, turning away from alien pleasures and turning toward the inherent pleasure of whatever she's doing, not only will the number of meaningless arrows decrease, and not only will she have the freedom to listen to music for its own sake, but the overall shape of Jane's life will assume a circle, a blue one, not chartreuse. Postlude, an attempt to persuade an unusual Jane to give asceticism and enjoyment a try. Unusual Jane, sister, you've said a lot of words, but you haven't persuaded me to care enough about your advice to give it a try. Why should I bother with asceticism when I live in a culture that will provide me with all the music I ever crave? You should care about my advice, Unusual Jane, for many reasons. Here are two. First, the more we depend upon music to get through our usual activities, the less capable we become of performing these activities without music. This means that our natural capacity to find enjoyment in the things that we have to do has atrophied. We should care about this atrophy because it means that we've lost the ability to enjoy being with other people and to enjoy being with ourselves, no matter what we're doing and no matter what we're feeling. Second, being caught in a second-order kinetic pattern is a meaningless hell. To prefer comfortably doing one thing so that you can do the next thing over the difficulty of discovering what's inherently delightful is to allow yourself to be ruled by fear. Unusual Jane. Even still, sister, what's the point of trying to be ruled by delight when I live in a culture in which everyone else is ruled by fear? How can I turn away from using music to enjoy other people if none of the people around me are able to enjoy me? You can't, Unusual Jane. Or at least, I don't recommend that you try to follow my advice alone. So perhaps the most fundamental piece of advice is this. If you wish to be free, first, look around for others who wish the same. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.